if what I'm doing and the research I'm doing can't and does not have impact on the people I care about most, then I need to reevaluate what I'm doing. And that made me realize that I needed to do something to translate what I was doing out to the community.
As I am apt to say, the Hawk Foundation is a mental health organization. Implicit in that is that we are a health organization. It stands to reason that to be in the business of mental health, that we are necessarily in the business of health. The business of health is huge and complicated and daunting. If you track the discourse of health in the way that I kinda do, you can't help but come away with the sense that our healthcare system is a convoluted and inhumane and inertial monster. And yet, in spite of that, it remains an article of faith for many Americans that our individual health is in large measure within our control. Or at least there's a lot about our day-to-day behavior that would be very hard to explain unless it were true that our health is largely our personal responsibility. I don't know about you, but I've always been a little bit perplexed by the ease with which we're able to hold both of these notions simultaneously. On the one hand, health as something that seems to resist us at every turn. A system that is opaque, that is at times seemingly arbitrary, brutally so. On the other hand, so much advice, so many nostrums, so much canned wisdom about all the things that we could be doing and should be doing to improve our own health. Our guest today is a man of science and an activist. My sense is that when it comes to health, we need men of science and we need activists to help us make sense of what health is, what it ought to be, and what are more and less useful ways of talking about it. I'm Mike Evans of the Hawk Foundation for Mental Health. You're listening to Into the Fold, the Hawk Foundation podcast. Like I just said, Hawk Foundation is a mental health grant-making foundation and part of the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more about the Hawk Foundation, our grant programs, and the other things that we have going on, visit us at www.hogg.utexas.edu. Dr. Lavelle Jones is a distinguished man of science as well as an activist, a molecular endocrinologist and expert on reproductive cancer who has earned numerous honors and distinctions in his field. He is also the first African American to be made a full professor at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. The real cause of his life is health inequities, and he has devoted himself for more than three decades to applying his considerable scientific knowledge to addressing systemic issues in our healthcare system. Dr. Lavelle Jones joining us via Skype. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So in the years since, well, I don't know if you were the one who first popularized the term, but I just know that your name is very strongly associated with health disparities. And in recent years, you know, those of us who work within that ecosystem have become accustomed to terms like underserved and disparities. So in your opinion, how much progress are we making on these fronts?
In some areas, we're making a lot of progress. In other areas, we are, I would say, falling back. The total progress, I would say, is maybe three steps forward and two steps back, to summarize it. And I think one of the reasons is that we have failed to approach this issue in a holistic manner. We're all in our little silos, and we fail to realize that there's a need to do this in a collaborative fashion that goes past just science, but also goes past the issue of the social determinants of health. And so the best example I can give you, well, it's a good example, is that when they were looking at the issue of lung cancer and treating it with vitamin A, they thought all they needed to do was to give people just vitamin A and that would solve the issue. And so they tried this in Europe in one of the Scandinavian countries. And what happened is they told people that all they needed to do was take this pill that was retinoids and that it would reduce the incidence of lung cancer. And what they found out is that those people who were just taking the pill, the lung cancer incidence went up. And what one was able to draw back from that, it was the entire diet that people were eating and not just one particular supplement. Although that supplement was crucial in terms of the reduction, it had to be done in a holistic way and not just one single ingredient. And I think in terms of health disparities, we still have failed to realize that.
Okay. Now, as much as anything else, you're a man of science, and your background is in endocrinology and tumor biology.
Right.
So was there some watershed moment for you that made addressing health disparities the prime concern that it is?
Yeah, it actually happened with regards to a family member, actually my mother. In that I had finished from Berkeley, had gotten a fellowship at the University of California, San Francisco. And as I was telling someone the other day, I had a nice office overlooking the Golden Gate Bridge, overlooking the Pacific. And I got a phone call from my dad saying that my mom was in the hospital. And my first inclination was she had gotten injured doing something in her garden, because she generally would do things when I was home that would kind of scare my dad, in that she would get up on ladders. And one time she actually, during the lull in the hurricane, went out to make sure her flowers were tied down and forgot the time, and the wind picked up and picked her up and took her a short distance. And so, you know, she was dedicated to her plants and stuff like that. Anyway, what happened is that she had been diagnosed with breast cancer, was in the hospital for surgery. And 6 months earlier, she had been out in California visiting me, and my wife said, "There's something wrong with your mom." And I said, "No, she's out here visiting, her favorite son and her grandchildren, and that woman that married him, because as an only child, as you may or may not know, only sons sometimes can be the apple of your mom's eye. No other woman is good enough." But anyway, my wife picked up on something that I did not pick up on, and she had come out basically to say goodbye to her son and to his family, because she thought breast cancer or cancer was an automatic death sentence. And even though I was working in one of the top cancer centers in the country, and my area was in terms of breast cancer, she still had that myth that it was an automatic death sentence. And so when that hit me, that really had an impact. And I basically said, if what I'm doing and the research I'm doing can't and does not have impact on the people I care about most, then I need to reevaluate what I'm doing. And that made me realize that I needed to do something to translate what I was doing in terms of the bench out to the community and to those individuals who were like my mom and those who were not, because my mom had the access to some of the best care anyone could get. Yet she had that myth or perception that once she developed the disease, it was automatic death sentence. So that changed my whole outlook.
Tell us a bit more about your background. What were some significant milestones on your way from where you started to, you know, MD Anderson and beyond?
How far back do you want me to go?
Yeah, because, you know, you live a lot of lives within a life, right? I don't know. Let's just say from the moment that you thought that you could make a decent living in science.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure that one out. I think, you know, I've always been interested in science. I mean, science, my mom was a science teacher. So let me go back. And so I've always had an interest in science. I've also known that being a person of color, that sometimes that does not blend with science. And what I mean by that is that when I was in middle school, I did a science project. In fact, the science project was putting a man on the moon and having that person survive there. And so I thought about that. Even that was even before the first Sputnik, I guess. And so I won an award, and that award was to spend some time, a week or so, at one of the bases that was developing the rockets to go in outer space. And then my parents made arrangements for me to go, when the individuals realized that I was African American, somehow the award disappeared, or at least that trip disappeared. And so that kind of hit me square in the face, and I realized that there were going to be barriers. I didn't know exactly what the barriers would be. But I've looked upon everything that I have been able to accomplish past that point as a milestone, because there have been barriers that would not have confronted others in terms of getting where I am today. So that's my answer.
Okay. So, I mean, what does the best research tell us about why it is that different segments of the population have such different health outcomes? I mean, it seems to me that it would be too complicated to reduce to a handful of factors. And so what more do we need to know?
Yeah, I go back to the idea that we need to approach this in a biopsychosocial or a holistic way. I think we have the data. It's just how we put it together. As someone once said to me a number of years ago, Herman R., who was at that time, the president of the American Cancer Society, and I had invited him to speak at the biennial symposium series on minorities, the medical and served in cancer. And he opened the session by saying, and these words have always stuck with me, that if we were able to communicate and implement what we know today without any new discoveries, we would be able to reduce the incidence of cancer by 50% and the mortality rate by 25% without any new discoveries. And that percentages could be even higher. And so that says to me that, you know, we're into the business of discovery, but we're not into the business of delivery. And that's not saying that we don't need discoveries for Fermat. I think we still need to look at mechanisms, or else I wouldn't be in the business I'm in. But we need to look at a better way of delivering it. And I think that, to me, is the key.
You co-founded the National Black Leadership Initiative. But what can you tell us about this organization?
Well, that came about also because of the need to communicate what we've discovered. The NBLIC, the National Black Leadership Initiative, actually came out of NCI's attempt to do community outreach. And in fact, it was the first successful effort by a group to actually be that bridge between science in terms of discovery and delivery. We set up regional groups across the country and tried to bring them together, both the science as well as the community outreach, to address the issue of cancer in underserved and Black communities. Our region actually went from Texas all the way up to South Dakota, which was interesting. I think even up to as far north as North Dakota. And so when we were looking at reaching out to each of the states, one of the individuals said to us, are there Black people in North Dakota? And I said, if there's a military base, there are Black people. If there's a college that plays football, there are Black people. And so that's what we used. We went to the Air Force base that was in South Dakota and started to organize some of the military people there who were African American, and did that in North Dakota as well as some of the other states that was not as well populated with African Americans, in terms of setting up a program that looked at leadership, looked at science and community outreach. And in fact, that led to, part of it led to the creation of the Intercultural Cancer Council, which is still going strong and is the largest multicultural health policy group in the country, that's now actually based out of Meharry Medical College.
As I alluded to in my intro, people are bombarded with health information, let's just call it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it would lead one to think that something like, even something like cancer is responsive to, you know, changes in personal behavior. Now, are you generally supportive of that kind of advice giving, or do you think it's a sidetrack, especially given, you know, all the data that I'm sure you've seen, you know, in the course of your career? Or is it something else for you?
Well, you know, I generally respond to questions like that. I say, you ask someone to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Suppose they have boots and no straps. How are you expecting them to do that? And I think it is some part of self-responsibility, but you have to provide that person with the tools so that they are successful in doing that. You know, you say to a group, well, I want you to eat healthy, but yet there's no means for them to get the foods that they need to eat healthy by. And then you come back and criticize them for not eating healthy when you haven't done anything or everything possible so that they can participate in that. And it doesn't mean that you have to have a full service grocery store, but you can look at the mom and pop stores that are in the area, the corner grocery stores, and work with them to provide nutritious food. They're in the business, making money and surviving, but you can show them how to make money by delivering healthy produce. But we don't do that. And so I think it's kind of, excuse the expression, but a half-assed way of addressing the problem by purring the finger and saying, you know, it's self-responsibility. Great. But provide them with the tools and the instruments and the knowledge to help themselves.
Okay. And so my last question. So you've accomplished an awful lot in your career. Of all the things that you've done, whether it's low profile or high profile, and I'm sure there are many different ways of answering this question, but what do you think best exemplifies, you know, you and what you've tried to accomplish and the change you're trying to help make?
That's an interesting question. And the reason why I say that is a friend of mine a couple of years ago asked me to be part of a book and write a chapter for that book. And the book basically is on servant leaders. And, you know, the basic definition of a servant leader is that when you look back on things that you've been able to accomplish, it's not what you have been able to accomplish, but it's been the people that you've helped, what they've been able to accomplish going forward. And I think that's probably the best answer I can give you, in that looking back now and what I'm doing with the remainder of my professional career is trying to track down all of the people that I have interacted with, from establishing the experimental gynecology laboratory to establishing the first congressionally mandated center for research on minority health, to the Intercultural Cancer Council, to the Biennial Symposium, to the Dorothy Heights Center for Health Equity and Evaluation Research, now to the HEART Consortium, or the Health Disparities Education Awareness Research and Training Consortium, going back and touching bases with all of the people who have come through those various entities and see where they are and what they're doing to continue to address the issue. And one of my mentors said, Howard Byrne, in fact, there have been a number of mentors in my life, but the two that I think about mostly is Howard, because he continued to instill in me as I was being mentored by him that your greatest contribution to science is not the papers you publish or the grants you obtain or the honors bestowed on you, but the people you leave behind to continue the work that's needed to be done. And then Finn Sittery, who was my postdoctoral mentor and continued to mentor me while he was still alive, is that the idea of let your science be your rock. No matter what you do, as long as you keep your professional integrity intact, you'll be able to lead others and point them in the right direction in terms of addressing issues that you think need to be addressed. So I guess that summarizes to a large extent where I see my accomplishments are and have been in the people that I've worked with and who've worked with me and will continue to do what the goals and objectives I have set forth, and maybe new goals and objectives to address the issue of health inequities until it's no longer needed to be addressed.
Okay. Dr. Lavelle Jones, Professor Emeritus at MD Anderson Cancer Center, being kind enough to Skype with us from Houston. There may be no bigger issue that future generations will have to confront than this whole issue of health and health disparities. And so we really appreciate you taking the time to share your perspective. Thanks so much.
No, thank you.
We have just heard from an expert on health inequity. Implicit in much of what Dr. Jones had to say is the relationship between eliminating disparities and cultural competency. This next segment is taken from a video that the Hogg Foundation recently produced with the help of our former film graduate assistant, Cameron Quevedo. The title is Bear Dancers. Its subject is Isaac Cardenas of American Indians in Texas of the Spanish Colonial Mission in San Antonio. The focal point is the Bear Dancers' traditional healing ritual. And as you listen to this, and it's about a 4.5 minute segment that's taken from a longer film, be receptive to what it has to teach us about all of the different ways that cultural competency can be utilized to address current needs and community problems. So we hope that you enjoy.
My name is Isaac Alvarez Cardenas. I had the Healing the Wounded Spirit mental health wellness program, and also a tribal member of the Tapilan Kwawiteke Nation and a spiritual practitioner and a mental health counselor. At this age, to bless the land, this event. We have a seasonal dance called the Bear Dance. It's about healing. Again, we're going with community healing. About 5-ish, get that fire going real good, 6-ish, and then come in here about a little close to 8 o'clock when we see that red sun, and then we'll start with our sweat. When I had children and I made a family, I came back to these ways, you know. I'm thankful for it. Just like my kids, they were brought up in these ways. They would sleep in a lodge like this. You know, they know about the sweat lodge. They know all about these things. So I raised them, little ones like that. But now they're men. And it's sad because I'm by myself with just me and my wife in the ceremonies. And I see other children coming, I remember, that's like my son. It's my sonny boy.
Are you excited for the sweat lodge? Or what do you think?
I don't want to go in there.
Why is that?
Too hot.
Too hot?
Mm-hmm.
It is pretty hot, no?
Mm-hmm. Huh? No, it is.
How about you, Nico? What do you think about the lodge?
It's hot. Like, in the lodge, it's hot.
Out here, it is too.
Yeah, out here, it is too. You know, when you commit yourself to being a drummer, you're supposed to be that that energy, that extra energy that is fed to the dancers, you know? While everything's going on, you know, they're in their own world and taking on people's burdens and people's hurts and anger and frustrations, because this ceremony itself is not done just around the seasons, you know, it's done around healing. And so anytime somebody needs some specific healing, you know, somebody's dying or they're sick, you know, and they want some prayer, you know, they'll call on these bear dancers, you know, and they'll call on this drum to come out and help, you know, and help heal and carry those burdens, you know, for those people.
Namkar.
there was a lot of teachings that we lost. When the strangers came over, they burned their books, they burned, you know, they cut the tree down. But what they didn't do is they didn't cut it to the root. So the tree's growing back. We're rerooting. We're reconnecting all these young people.
That was Bear Dancers. Again, if you would like to see the entire video, you can find it on our YouTube page. Credit once again to our awesome former film graduate assistant, Cameron, for shooting the film. And that does it for this edition of Into the Fold. We hope that you enjoyed it. I felt that an episode exclusively devoted to the issue of health disparities was long overdue. If you have any ideas or suggestions, email me at imani.evans@austin.utexas.edu. Thanks so much for joining us.